Hi, I'm Natalie Gochner. This is Both Sides of the Aisle, and I represent the political center and have on the political left Miss Shireen Gourbani.
Hello, and hi, listeners. So glad you're with us.
And Mr. John Dougal on the right.
Hey, great to be with you again.
Yeah, happy to be in studio. And Shireen and John, I'm thinking about this, but my area of...
First, congratulations. New grandbaby. We got
you.
A shout out there. So
yeah,
congratulations.
Thanks for that.
Enjoy.
My first. I got a little grandson from my daughter, Rose. So excited.
It's so exciting.
Yeah, I'll give an update in a future podcast as well. My expertise is more in domestic policy than foreign policy. You know, working for governors, working at EPA, which is domestic, HHS, mostly domestic. But boy, do we have a boatload of foreign policy news.
Yeah.
And let's just go with the big one and talk about Israel, where the death toll in Gaza and Israel tops 1,300. Israel's declared war on Hamas. Just heinous crimes committed at a music festival. 120,000 people displaced, Shireen.
Yeah.
Wow.
It's horrific. It's impossible to give the amount of context necessary to understand mm-hmm. really what has happened in the history of the conflict between Israel and Palestine. So I'm not going to even attempt to do that. But what I will say, and I think we can agree, is this kind of brutality is humanitarian failure beyond, I think, what most of us can really think, like conceptualize.
Mm-hmm.
And I do also think that it feels like we've had these moments where there's discussion of, you know, movement towards peace, nonviolent solutions, movement towards potentially a two-state solution or other, you know, solutions that mm-hmm. might bring greater stability to the region. And we are so far from that. And I think from my perspective, it's easy to try to run to your political corners or jump to conclusions here, but to really sit with the devastation for the people of Palestine, for mm-hmm. Israelis,
absolutely,
is critically important, and to understand just how deeply violent and the broader implications of destabilization for this region are scary.
Yes. John, don't expect any of us to be foreign policy experts or anything in this, but it's interesting how the progress that was being made by Israel and Saudi Arabia mm-hmm. looms large.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to hear you comment on that because, you know, the way I understand the Middle East is, you know, it's really hard to get peace. We had the Abraham Accords where Israel and the United Arab Emirates came together, and there was similar movement with Saudi Arabia. It's really huge economically and really shows progress as nation states, but it looks like neighbors didn't like that.
Yeah, so let's go back. I mean, the fighting over there has been going on for millennia.
Mm-hmm.
So this isn't like, you know, hey, the last 100 years, something like that. It's been going on for millennia.
Mm-hmm.
And that
we don't use that term very often in public policy.
No. You know, it's stuff we can never
hemispheric
remember
millennia.
And stuff like that. And we try and learn about it from history, but we can't even really understand it then. And so these animosities in this, infighting between the various parties has been going on, if you will, back to Abraham. And so then you look forward and say, okay, coming out of World War II, the Holocaust and everything else created the State of Israel, displaced Palestinians. There's been agitation in the region for decades from that point going forward. I think it's fair to say Israel, every time they face a crisis like this, they believe it's existential.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not, not only will they exist as a country, but will they exist as a people
mm-hmm.
and stuff like that. And so you look and say, okay, they've made peace with Egypt. They were making peace with Saudi Arabia. Iran still celebrates whenever Israel gets attacked and stuff like that. And so the Israelis are known for their intelligence, for their military, other things like that. And the
amount that they were
caught by surprise by what took place,
mm-hmm.
I think, is shocking the world. And I fear, okay, yeah, Israel declared war, but they would argue that war was declared on them first. They're just responding.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm fearful what kind of devastation will take place. I think clearly Hamas and military targets, fair game, but the population on both sides, innocent people that will get caught up and killed or injured in this fighting.
Yeah.
Shireen said, horrific.
And I think it's also really important to separate out, to think about this in terms of regimes, potentially dictatorial authoritarian leaders, terrorist organizations that have established power, and the people, right?
Mm-hmm.
Iranians generally are not supportive of what's happening in the region. Mm-hmm. Like you talk to everyday people And the perception is very different than what a regime or a dictator may be forcing through. I think this is, I guess the other piece of that, you know, again, impossible to provide context to explain the murder of children, right? Like, we need major intervention. I think we need leadership that's pulling towards peace. And what is happening in the region is, it feels unstoppable at this point.
I wasn't thinking of bringing this up, but it makes me all the more offended at what's happening in the U.S. House of Representatives or in Washington, D.C.
Well, before you go there.
Yeah, okay.
One of the interesting dynamics is you looked over there with Benjamin Netanyahu and kind of the agitation about the courts and other things like that and the infighting in Israel. And some speculate whether that disruption caused people to say, hey, let's take advantage of this opportunity right now.
Disarray in the government.
Super interesting.
So then jump to what you're saying.
Well,
speaker, who's got the speaker, right?
Well, yeah, I'm just sort of like, our world needs order. It needs maturity. It needs rule of law. It needs examples. It needs mentors. It needs strategy, you know, and the U.S. can absolutely provide that. And yet look at what we do, things we completely control. And so this disarray in the House, this is shameful that our country's letting that happen. And I'm so mad at our legislators. I'm even mad at the Utah congressional delegation because I want some messages out there that bonds people together and say, enough.
So I read an interesting piece that made me think of you, Natalie. I almost texted to you that really said, you know, if people who find themselves in the middle politically decided to have some courage, a lot could get done, right?
Because we have
plenty of centrists who would be able to, or people who are interested in the pragmatic moving forward of government who could come together in this moment to show some real leadership. But it would require stepping probably in dangerous ways for their maybe future election prospects away from party. And I wonder what it would take.
Well, a thought that I had, I was just walking. You know, sometimes when you're in the shower, or you're walking and you get these epiphanies, these ideas. I'm thinking about Congress while I'm just in idle time. And I'm thinking
about condolences.
Like I know. Why am I doing that?
Our listeners are probably with you.
But what I thought about is the culture's messed up. It's the culture that's the problem. And I say that because when you work with organizations or nonprofits or families, communities, cultures, everything, right? The old business thing is culture eats strategy for breakfast, right? And the culture in Washington's wrong because we can send great people there, but they have to fit in to this culture that doesn't work. And so if I were in Congress, I would create a culture caucus.
I love this idea.
That changes the very foundations of how we do things, and respect is at the top of the list, and dignity, you know, and these things that there's things we don't violate, and we start to change the culture. Anyway, we probably should talk about other things. That's a big topic. But
too many Americans on both sides of the aisle want a Congress that doesn't work. I mean, we talk that we want one that works, but we reward polarization. We reward sound bites on the media, other things like that.
John, I loathe this about, you know, far right conservatives. It's happened on this program many times where the person that's representing the right says, we like the dysfunction because then government can't do anything and government intervenes too much. And I loathe that thought.
Are you talking about Dan?
Hi, Senator McKay. Well, yeah, I mean, he and I could talk about it. We would talk about it. But I've heard John, I think, say that. But I don't like it because government exists for a reason.
Right.
And what we need to do is, you know, shape our government, help our government. It's a hard job, but we don't need dysfunction.
But if you look at the situation right now, you had, if you will, 8 Republicans, so a very small number, 8 Republicans say, we don't want this speaker. We want something else. And you had essentially all the Democrats join with them in that process.
No, they did not. I mean, that is a mischaracterization.
Was there a Democrat that voted to preserve the speaker?
It's not our job to bail out your party. Your party brought this.
This is a speaker that represents the entire House. And so I'm saying.
I just want to say.
And for various reasons.
Didn't happen with Nancy Pelosi.
For various reasons. But it was in their incentive. It was in their interest to say, okay, we'll let you guys blow yourself up in the process.
I like Shireen's talking point there. But I would tell you, I would have kept the speaker in.
All you needed to do was just have a few Democrats say, we're going to just vote present. And it would have altered the dynamics. Mm-hmm. And literally the Sunday before this took place.
That's where my culture.
I watched the folks, the Problem Solving Caucus, a Republican and Democrat, talking about the importance of coming together and getting through this, making sure we have a budget and making sure, you know, speaker and stuff like that. And then a few days later, it was a few militant Republicans who had some valid concerns and some self-serving interests, I believe. And then the Democrats saying, well, we'll just stand here and watch you guys.
Fascinating. Yeah. John and Shereen, take me real quickly away from Israel, away from the U.S. Capitol. Come to Mexico and look at what AMLO, the president's doing, where he's rejecting these plans for a border wall. I'm really fascinated at watching what President Biden's doing here.
Yeah.
I think it has politics written all over it.
So do you want to maybe tee up a little bit? So we have the Biden administration approving additional construction of a border wall.
That will never happen.
And he said it would never happen, but money was appropriated, kind of hiding behind that. I think politics is a crazy game, but I think sometimes politicians are led by polls.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the Biden administration here sees that we got to be doing something in this campaign year to show aggression on the border. John? I think that's what I'm reading in the tea leaves.
That's part of the dynamic. I think there is more.
Agree,
there is more than just money was appropriated.
Yeah.
I do. I also, a wall is not working. It's not going to work.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that there are actual border solutions that can be driven by technology, but there is a lot more that could be done that would be much more effective than the amount of money we're going to drop on a wall that does basically nothing.
Watch.
But if we go back to Israel, I think that will call for more Americans clamoring for a wall.
Oh, interesting.
Because the wall with Gaza Strip.
Watch Biden get more miles of wall than Trump did.
Yeah.
Just mark my words on that. Hey, let's take a quick break. I'm Natalie Gochner with Shereen Gourbani and John Dugal. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider donating to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Shereen Gourbani on the left.
John Dugal on the right.
Natalie Gochner in the political center, and this is Both Sides of the Aisle. All right, you two, I want your predictions. We talked a little bit about all the chaos in the House. Right now we've got Representatives Jim Jordan, Steve Scalise are the two leading candidates. Shereen, what's your prediction?
So not Donald Trump, huh?
I mean, that would be such a slight on Jim Jordan, wouldn't it? So I actually had also heard this morning that Kevin McCarthy said he would do it again.
Oh, my. I had not heard that.
So you know, I feel like it could be a real Groundhog's Day situation. I'm wondering if Steve Scalise has some momentum.
Uh-huh.
I think he feels like the likely next one to me. Mm-hmm. I don't know. That's where I'm at.
Where are you at, John?
If I had a guess, especially between the two, I would think Steve Scalise probably has the better chance. He's currently in leadership. He's the number two guy in leadership. Can speak well with various factions in the House. I think probably the view is Jim Jordan is probably going to be viewed as more polarizing.
Mm-hmm.
I think the one thing that we can probably predict is the House Republicans don't want to go through another 15 rounds of voting on the floor. And so they will try and figure out and hash things out behind closed doors to try and figure out who can get a majority of the caucus. I mean, not a majority of the caucus, but a majority of the House out of their caucus to make this happen so they can go on the floor and just have one vote and call it good.
Yeah.
I think they're highly motivated to do that. The question is, can they find a candidate that can get 218 votes out of that caucus?
Well, and both of those candidates have baggage, right? Steve Scalise has, you know, very troubling history of having spoken at a white supremacist rally, basically, and said that he didn't know at the time, which is an odd thing not to know. He is also dealing with some significant health problems, which I think makes the job challenging.
Cancer, and I think he still has some lingering effects from being,
shot
by a crazy person or terrorist, whatever
treatment.
Term you want to use.
Right. He's in treatment, which has got to be incredible to be thinking about balancing that and what has to be one of the most demanding jobs in government. And Jim Jordan has a long history of allegations of ignoring reports and knowledge of sexual misconduct when he was at Ohio State. Mm-hmm. Right,
he was a wrestling coach.
Yeah. And I just am like, is this the best you guys can do? This doesn't feel great. But I do think Steve Scalise feels a little less oriented to chaos.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I was in the same camp, so all three of us think that Scalise has the leg up. I hadn't heard the McCarthy news. I just throw out there, I wouldn't be surprised if there's still someone waiting in the wings, you know, given the baggage and things you're talking about. Let's come to more local news. Shereen, we want to talk about housing a little bit. I'm always reluctant to, like, make this program be a feature of Gardner Institute reports, which I lead, but we do a lot of housing work, and you had an interest in it.
Yeah, well,
this is our economics 101.
This is our what's happening in Salt Lake County quarter. So this is really interesting to me, and I do have to give you credit for this because I feel like I'm the one who's always like, how about we talk about the Gardner report about this? But Andy Larson did a really interesting piece in the Trib over the weekend that was talking. The title is just how out of reach is Salt Lake County's rental market, and part of that started off with talking about the housing market, right? Mm-hmm. And the median income stood out to me. So the median income in Salt Lake County, and I'll just give people kind of a second to guess, is reported at $47,000. And when you think about that and you think about what's happening in our housing market, a couple of numbers stood out to me. So 95% of homes sold were sold at over $300,000. 75% of homes sold are sold at over $400,000. When you think about what people need to enter the housing market here, it is way out of reach for far too many Utahns. And there are so many things that we could discuss in terms of what does it mean for engagement in the workforce? What do we think about a living wage in the state? Mm-hmm. On and on and on down the list, right? The power or lack of power of unions, all of those kinds of opportunities that we could talk about to increase people's economic stability and opportunity. But then there's the other side of it is if you're not owning a home, you're renting. Mm-hmm. And we know that rent has increased rapidly in Salt Lake County, is very expensive and out of reach for a lot of people. And one of the things that I so value about what the Gardner Institute does is really provide, first of all, I'm wonky. I like the numbers. I like the charts. I like the data. Mm-hmm. But it also provides some solutions. And this is complicated. But I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about the report or some of the things that stood out to you as solutions around housing.
Yeah. And John, bring you into the conversation here to just say, I'm going to be curious what you think government can do with your government experience, John. So I'm just giving you that heads up. Shireen, this caught us by surprise. Yeah. This has not been an issue until about 2018 when prices started to shoot up. It's a supply issue. We came through the Great Recession and the building industry was just, you know, eviscerated. And we lost a lot of progress that was being made, new homes and whatnot. And at the same time, all of these people moving to Utah.
Yeah.
And so it's a relatively new thing. It's shocking to me that there's only six states with a higher median single family housing price than Utah. That's stunning.
Yeah.
Because just start naming states. You know Hawaii is going to be. You know California. You know Massachusetts is going to be. But, you know, we are expensive.
Yeah, we're up there.
We're up there. And Shireen, you're really asking about solutions. I mean, the way I think of this is government matters in this case. Government can help. When you want more of something, you subsidize it. We need more tax credits. We need a housing preservation fund to preserve affordable housing. Local government ordinances really matter here. We have too much NIMBYism. We have too many communities that lock out density when they shouldn't. Density can be done right. It's never the goal. It's just that with density, you get more walkability, you get more community, you get lower prices, you get density, but done well, it's a really good thing. Those are some of the things on my list, John. What do you think government should do here?
Well, I would say government needs to stop doing so many of the things they're doing that screw up the market.
I thought you might.
Yeah. So.
Well, and can you give us an example?
Huh? Yeah, so let me go through. First of all, our cities are basically funded on sales tax, and they feel like they lose money on the property tax, and so they have a disincentive to allow residential properties, whether it's apartments or even just single family homes on large lots. They just have they're incentivized to zone for retail, which is a problem right there from my perspective. They shouldn't have that disincentive against residential stuff. Talk about zoning constraints. That's another problem. We place so many constraints. Mm-hmm. We have people that think, through our government, we can mandate this type of housing and this type of supply and stuff like that. That is a problem from my perspective. I would disagree with you also on incentives. Mm-hmm. I think we've thrown too many corporate incentives at folks enticing people to come to Utah, which has increased the demand for housing and has artificially stimulated
it's
when it wasn't necessary.
Yeah. It's interesting. I would agree with you on that. I'm not opposed to that. But I do think incentives for low-income housing
is different than incentives
are vital because the market's broken there.
Yeah, I agree.
And I would say that from my perspective, so many times when government weighs in with incentives and they think they can pick and choose this and that, they cause all sorts of other unintended consequences. And then you talked about, clearly the downturn with the market and the drying up of home builders. And then also, I would say, the supply chain with COVID and government actions when it came to COVID that really disrupted the supply chain.
Sure.
Well, and actually,
the crazy
thing
is, though, that a lot of, the COVID affected everyone, and whatnot. And interest rates affect everyone. What's unique to Utah is that we did not create the new building that we needed to way before COVID.
Right.
We were getting up to a 50,000 housing unit short.
Deficit, yeah.
And then the other thing that's hurt us is, yeah, we're a magnet state. We're a destination state. People have been moving here.
Yeah. I think there are a couple other pieces that I would add to that. And certainly we've talked numerous times on the show about the labor shortage. The labor shortage specifically in trades and construction is real. So that drives up costs. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned COVID, but I also remember quite a bit of destabilization that happened around issues like lumber, steel, and a lot of the chaos that was driven there was driven by decisions that the Trump administration made that really made some of those key imports and some of those key, you know, factors in construction costs really jump.
Yeah, one more time, government's screwing it up.
I'm going to say that was a really special time.
Yeah, John, I want to not...
The key takeaway is it's a complex issue.
It's complex.
There's not like one solution to this.
Yeah, and it's a hard one for government. This is not pushback to you or to Shireen, but just something that's really lit up in my mind over the last 6 months or something. That is that we have so many challenges and so much has changed in our world that we all need to keep an open mind. And sometimes ideology gets in the way of an open mind, both, you know, from wherever side you are. And what we need are innovations. That deal with the new, you know, Utah or the ground has shifted. So on your points about government messing up or getting involved too much, I'm just encouraging you to have an open mind and be willing to let the ideology, you know, wall drop down a little bit and listen and learn about some sort of policy innovation and see if it could actually break through.
I would similarly say, you know, Let's stop thinking because government doesn't innovate from my perspective. Let's let people innovate and let's leave people freer to decide what's going on.
Yeah, yeah. But what could we do in government to make it more innovative? And so let's go to this. There's so many things, so much news. But let's go to this Representative Quinn Cotter, who wrote this fiery farewell letter. This is a representative from West Valley City, went through one legislative session, eight months in office. But as he leaves, he writes a letter that's basically scorns his former Republican colleagues for mostly the process on Capitol, how they rushed things, some of the votes that he regrets, and basically had a bad experience is how I would say it.
I can provide some context for that.
Yeah,
he writes, I want you to know that all of the vitriol that was thrown at my heart, the worst came from Republican Party leaders right here in his own district. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the part that people, I don't know, always see. Mm-hmm. Some of the most intense criticism I received was from people on the left. Mm-hmm. I know that just is, that's the game. But it is incredibly disheartening, toxic, even frightening, kind of depending on how that communication comes in.
I bring it up in the context of innovation and open mind, because here's someone who arguably went in with his eyes wide open to try and do something and had a bad experience. And, you know, he has to own some of that, no question in my mind. But I also just wonder about how much reform we need to be, to level up to the challenges we face.
Well,
political reform.
Yeah, but we've created this world in which people feel like it's, you know, all the stakes are in government. And so therefore, we got to fight over what's going on there rather than just saying, hey, get it out of our lives and let us decide for ourselves. And so, you look, some of those in your own party, they're most militant because you weren't pure to what they expected, and you had to make some deals to get some stuff done.
Yeah. So Mitt Romney's new book is going to be really interesting on this point because he's got some grievances he's going to share. So just to our listeners, let's watch for that. Yeah. John, I don't want to end this program without talking about Mr. Ballard, Tim Ballard. Wow. The depth of the, you know, reporting about the behaviors.
Oh, the allegations that are there and stuff like that.
And they're everywhere. Yeah. I don't know. Shireen, you're really good at like giving the one-liner of what's been exposed.
Right. Well, I'll just say that basically what is happening is there continue to be deeply distressing allegations that are now, you know, coming to the form of lawsuits around sexual improprieties and exploitation of individuals who got involved, basically to the glorification of Tim Ballard. And this is
Under the umbrella of
Operation Underground Railroad.
Yes, serving enslaved children.
Yes. And this is just a heartbreaking, but also just disgusting story. And this is something that has been, like, Tim Ballard's behavior has been reported on for many years. The fact that this is kind of breaking open in Utah now suggests to me that we really do live in separate media ecosystems. But I do hope there's some accountability for what is truly really reprehensible behavior.
John, well, what are you seeing on Capitol Hill or even just in your, you know?
I haven't seen much Capitol Hill and other things like that. I think folks are probably just shocked at what they're hearing.
And distancing themselves.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and others that just were not close to it. And so I think what you're going to see is clearly these allegations are going to continue to roll out. But I think you're going to see some folks who were donors starting to question how their donations were used and whether there was any kind of fraud engaged in soliciting those donations, promises of what they were going to use the money for that wasn't reality.
Yeah. You know, sometimes bad really is bad.
Yeah.
And when it starts to come from all sides, like we're seeing here, it feels like there's actually some evil here.
Yeah.
So, all right. I'm Natalie Gochner in the Political Center. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle with Shireen Gourbani and John Dougal. The program's produced by Anthony Scoma. Thanks, everybody, for listening.